Velkommen tilbage. Så er klokken 15, og vi er klar til det næste indslag. For et års tid siden, der rejste vi nogen fra bestyrelsen til Madrid på en international vejlederkonference. Og det var vældig givende for os, men vi synes også, at når vi nu rejste derned for medlemmernes penge, så skulle det også være lidt givende for jer. Derfor så tog vi en mand med hjem. Det er ham, der står her. Ham tog vi med hjem, og han er professor i vejledning på et universitet i Barcelona. Så han er kommet her på trods af vejspærringer og meget andet. Men det som han kan, det som vi i hvert fald synes, at han kan, og nu siger jeg det jo på dansk, så derfor kan han ikke høre og forstå, hvad det er. Han kan godt høre det, men han kan ikke forstå, hvad det er, han kan. Men det fortæller jeg jer nu. Det han kan, det er, at han kan give os troen på vejledningen tilbage. Det siger dem, der hørte ham sidste gang. Og det ved jeg ikke om Lisbeths oplæg, det gav os måske også lidt troen på vejledningen tilbage, men i hvert fald, så vil det blive fuldt op nu af en, der også kan det. Så jeg vil gerne byde velkommen til Marius Martinez, som vil holde sit oplæg for os på engelsk. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. So, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Marius Martinez. I belong to the Autonomous University of Barcelona, a 40,000 students university, born 50 years ago. So it's a very young university, exactly like me. I belong to a tiny group of research called Diversity and Guidance, and I would like to thank Lotte and all the team from this Young Education Counselors Association, and I'm very happy to share some ideas with you this afternoon. I hope they will interest you. If not, you will have the chance to say it. I come from Catalonia, which is a very little part of this territory called Spain for the moment. Maybe you are familiar with some of the cultural issues about my country, but in the recent times, maybe you have heard something else. But I think that you keep in mind these images, not the other ones. And here we are today to talk about social justice, but from this perspective, I come from Catalonia. I've been working with your colleagues in Catalonia for the last 25 years, in prisons, in secondary schools, and in vet schools, and in adult education schools as well. So I believe that we have some backgrounds in common, and that will be the starting point. From my point of view, if we want to talk about social justice, I will start talking about itineraries, the itineraries that young people or adults or people in jail are following. And in these itineraries, I think we have to pay attention to some of the transition they have to face. So to talk about social justice, I would like to start from that. So let's start. Facing transitions. Of course, we know that a transition is a moment in which a person changes something in his or her life. But for me, the most important thing in a transition is not that moment at all, but the process from which you prepare, from which you empower yourself and your peers to face that transition. And that's for me a crucial idea because I come from the field of education. And in education, of course, that you have to keep in mind these moments in which you change. But to prepare that moment, the important path, the important thing is what you do for a long period of time to prepare yourself, to train yourself, to empower yourself, to motivate yourself, to increase your expectation and your aspirations to face that transition. And if we deal with social justice in that processes, we help people to have reasonable chances, or we don't. In my opinion, we live in structurally changing societies. So change is not a phenomenon that occurs now and then we will have again a period of stability. This has changed, and now we are facing changes all the time. So change is not conjunctural, but structural. Change is something that defines societies nowadays. And my generation grew thinking that changes were always for good, were always something that brought us to a better stage. For the last decade, at least, this has changed completely. And now most of the changes leads us to a worse situation than where we used to be. So in order to face these changes that are structural, we have to work collaboratively. And this will be one of my mottos, one of my main ideas this afternoon. So we have to talk about life transitions, which are occurring during all our lives, during all the lives of people who are... it's difficult to speak English when you speak normally in Catalan only. I'm sorry for that. And I apologize that I don't speak Danish. Okay, let's start again. I was saying that we have to face life transitions, and we have to work with people facing daily transitions and changes during all the life, all their lives, but also all our lives as well. So if we are considering these transitions, what this little goldfish needs, what does people that we work with need to face these transitions from this social justice perspective? Of course, we can consider that they will have success or failure if we attend on how successful or not are these transitions. So if we pay attention to that trajectories, we will be able to know if they have been successful or not. How do we work with these young or adults from a social justice perspective? I like to talk about, I don't know if the concept would be translated like this, but it could be said as a double-edged concept. So a concept which becomes popular, becomes widely accepted, but it has two edges. So depending on how we threaten that or we conceive that concept, we can work for social justice or we can work for social reproduction. The first one is the nature of counseling or guidance. As I said, I conceive this work as a process, not as an isolated action. So the first double-edged concept for me is consider guidance or counseling as a service rather than as a program or as a continuous action. In my country, unfortunately, some counselors, some guidance practitioners consider their job as just simply doing interviews, isolated interviews, for example. In many of the international congresses I've been to, participants are called clients. In my opinion, if we talk about processes, we have to talk about participants. Because a client is someone who activates a service if there's a need, if there's a perceived need. But in my opinion, in my experience, most of the people I have been working with don't realize they have a need. They simply don't know they have that need. Maybe they are lost, and they don't know they are lost. So in my opinion, the first double-edged concept is considering rather counseling or guidance as an isolated action, as something that you can resolve by a single action with most of these people. This doesn't work for social justice. Second, information as counseling or information as guidance. This is a very old concept, but it's still a problem. There's a lot of people who consider that guiding is simply a matter of informing people. Let's make a session, let's give information to people, and with that information, they will be able to decide, for example. That's completely false. in the learning and information society. Information grows exponentially. So there's more information that those you are able to process. You need something else. Information is something to start with, but it is not what we do with people mainly. When we talk about motivation, when we talk about self-esteem, when we talk about collaboration, we are dealing with information, of course, but we are going forward. Information is not enough. And in some prospects, in some documents in my country, they still talk about the need of more information for people. People need information to make decisions, they say. And that's not enough. Don't get confused. If you simply inform, you are not counseling. You are not guiding. You are just informing. Third, ICTs will solve everything 24/7. So let's develop computer programs, mobile apps, available 24/7, and this will be it. Available maybe in some different languages as well. Available in your phone for free. And let's fire all the counselors and all the guidance practitioners who were doing that job before. Of course, ICT is an opportunity of increasing possibilities of getting in touch with information, with relevant information, with relevant documents, and so on. But of course, again, if we consider vulnerable people, ICTs is going to be something that will, again, make a difference between those informed, those included, and those excluded. In my country, there are different groups that have no access to ICT, or if they have access, they simply don't understand what's going on there. They need something else. And guidance and counseling deals with this interaction between people, always, between peers and between counselors and participants, between guidance practitioners and participants. So careful with ICTs. Of course, it's a new opportunity, but it could be a new barrier for some of them. Fourth, credentials and empowerment. That's what they need. So let's train them a lot. Let's provide them any kind of course they can do, any kind of credential, of diploma. If you have a higher education diploma, then you can go for a second higher education diploma. And if you have two, then you can go for a postgraduate diploma, and then for some languages, and then for some experience. Everything accredited with a lot of certificates. And with that, you will get empowered to what? To go where? To do what? To compete with who? Let's make them competitive. If you work with a person who is illiterate, you have to convince that person that he has to become, he or she has to become literate. Of course, that's true. If you work to a person with only lower secondary school, let's convince him or her to have higher secondary school, and so on. And that's because we compare them with others. And that's because we have accepted that we have to accumulate credentials. The more credentials you will have, the more chances you will have in life. That's not true. I have had in a master's degree people with 4 master's degrees. And they were still not knowing what to do, where to go. So, of course, it is important to have a training. Of course, it is important to have credentials. But that's not the solution. That's not enough at all. And that makes some people with credentials feel as lost as those without credentials. And that's a huge group nowadays. In my country, we have more people with higher education credentials than the average in the OECD. And we have a huge percentage of unemployment and of demotivation from vast groups of people. That proves that credentials is not enough. For what purpose? Of course, some experience will also be welcome. So once you will have a lot of credentials, then please have experiences. Travel, work, no matter in what. But you have to gain some experience and to record that in your CV. That will make you a little bit more powerful. But it's still not enough. It is still not enough. Which kind of experience? Which type of experiences do we evaluate? Everything counts. It's only labor experience. What about working in an NGO? What about collaborating in an association? What about being a political activist? What about playing a sport? Does it count? In my country, and in most of the neoliberal countries, there was a tendency from which governments has tried to convince civil society that they are responsible about what's happening around them. So we have unemployment. Okay, you, the civil society, you are responsible for that. Work to change that. Get a commitment to fight against unemployment. And that's a way of just leaving responsibilities. So it's not the government's duty, it's the civil society duty. And in a neoliberal society, this is in the mood. So a lot of people considers that, yes, they have to be engaged on that, they have to be committed on that, because it's all of us duty to work against unemployment, against exclusion. Of course that's right, but this doesn't mean that governments reject this responsibility. In a welfare society, governments, public administrations, which are the administrations for everybody, should be responsible for that. And finally, the last concept, entrepreneurship. So once you will gain a lot of credentials, once you will have a lot of experience, nobody will take care of you. You will have to take care of yourself, being an entrepreneur. That's the last frontier they have crossed. And we have get convinced that we have to prepare people to become entrepreneurs. Because that means that they will fight for their own rights alone, and nobody will take care for them. Of course, entrepreneurship could mean different things. But in most of the cases in my country, people is so excited to introduce entrepreneurship courses, programs, and activities in lower secondary, in higher secondary, because they have understood that they have to train people to become isolated competitive machines. A very typical image on a neoliberal contemporary society. Okay, in our southern Judeo-Christian societies, there's another tradition which is not helping us to consider social justice, which is this, as I call it, a linear tradition. And it comes from this culture, because in this Judeo-Christian culture, of course, we have learned that from Genesis, we will go to apocalypse. From birth, we will go to disease. And then if we translate these ideas into the education system or into the vocational path or in your personal life, you will have to do primary education, then secondary education, then post-compulsory education, then work. And then you will die. You will have a couple, you will have a first son, a second son, then grandsons, and then you will die. Of course, you will gain some degree of independence, you will have housing problems, then you will have to look for a second residence, a second house in the countryside, in the beach, wherever, and then you will die. and everything is considered into this linear perspective. So if you are aged 12, you should be somewhere. If you are aged 16, you should be somewhere else. If you are 18, you should be somewhere else. If you are 22, you should be almost entering the labor market. If you are 26, how many sons do you have? And so on. I've said Southern Judeo-Christian traditions. Of course, you are a little bit more developed. But in my country, this is still a problem, because when a young adult, age 26, is not in the place he or she should be, he or she felt depressed because she hasn't followed that line. And I have students at the university, aged 20, that are so worried that they are repeating a subject or repeating a course. And they are so worried because there is no time to waste. And they are 20. So this linear conception has made a lot of damage in my country, because everybody is in a hurry trying to follow this regulation, this non-written regulation. Of course, they don't consider making a stop, making a sabbatical period, for example, after higher education, just to consider what to do in the future, what to do with their own path or whatever. Once I've been an Erasmus student, long time ago, in the Netherlands, and I was so surprised that most of my colleagues, after higher education, they have done a stop. Maybe a semester stop, or maybe mainly a one-year stop. And that was considered normal there, because they did that. They stopped, they maybe worked a little, maybe traveled a little, if they had money enough. And during that period, they were developing other type of skills and other type of understanding on what was going on around them. That was completely impossible to establish in my country, because if you stop, you never start again. You have to consider our climate as well to understand that position. That's true. That's true. What to do here in December outside? If you come to Barcelona, you will know. But what is true is that there's a lot of itineraries that are not linear, and they could be successful as well. In fact, there's a lot of people with non-linear itineraries. When I got married, I thought that was going to last for life. And it didn't. Like in the Goose play or in the Monopoly, there's a lot of itineraries that are not linear. And they are normal. And they could be successful, because when you stop, when you drop out, when you have an early failure in school, you have to consider that some new opportunities are in front of you. And that's a chance. That's not a disaster. It's a chance to reconsider what to do and how to do it. If we talk about social justice, we have to abandon this linear perspective on guidance, counseling, and education, because there's a lot of people failing and standing again and redesigning again some type of path of education, of opportunities in their life. There's another interesting question for me, considering these social justice issues in guidance and counseling, which is the conception of guidance itself or counseling itself. Maybe you are familiar with that. That's the Life Career Rainbow by Donald Sapper, who was a person devoted to these issues for 50 years in his life. And he proposed this sort of rainbow in which he specified different activities that a person can develop during the life. There was two nice ideas in that, from my point of view. First, considering a career, a life career. And a life career is defined as all the activities that you develop during your life. Not only the training activities, not only the labor activities, but also those activities that involve you as a citizen or as a member of an organization or as a peer with your group of friends or whatever. Of course, some of these activities are more intense in a certain period of your life. This is in Japanese because sometimes a lot of people don't understand that. But I think the interesting idea is the drawing, not the text. So this is life. You're born here, you are 10 years, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, etc. And then here you know what happens. Of course, there are periods with more intensity. For example, in this one, let's suppose that this is the training period. It's very intense until you are 15 or 16 during compulsory education. Then it decreases a little because then it increases a little the activities that you develop, for example, in the labor market or whatever. Or you become a citizen, an active citizen, maybe a little later on when you are 18 or 20 or whatever. But the interesting thing for me is the combination of these and considering all the activities you do in your life. And this leads to the concept of lifelong and life-wide guidance or counseling. And this means that when you counsel a person, when you are counseling with a group of participants, you have to consider not only the activity that they are currently developing there, training, education, but also the rest of activities this person is developing in his or her life. Because at the same time, that person is a student, but is maybe a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and at the same time is a player of a team, and at the same time is a citizen, and at the same time is a member of a family. And all this makes sense and gives you a whole idea of what this person is or is not. And you have to get profit of all these different activities that this person is developing simultaneously. My students at the university say, don't say me anything. I'm just finishing my studies. Then when I will finish, I will consider other opportunities or chances. And for me, that's an error. Because you have to overlap this analysis. Of course, most of the time you are studying. But at the same time, you are doing other things. And those skills that you are developing in these other activities may help you a lot in your path, in your career. So the first idea for me is that the itineraries are not linear. And especially in vulnerable people, these disruptions can be successful disruptions. And this is a key concept. For example, when a person failing from the system redefines, reconceptualizes his career and starts a new successful itinerary. The example of this person is really useful for others. Really useful for others. And this is an example of a non-linear, disruptive, successful itinerary. There's another idea that I want to share with you. These two different rationalities. I was mentioning the first one when I spoke about credentials and all of this. This superheroes discourse, or an alternative, let's say, emerging discourse, considering the importance of collaboration. The first one, this superhero discourse, considers people as in the figure there, in the picture, I mean. So it has an individual base. People must be fighting against everything individually because we are all different. They have to gain credentials. They have to gain experience. They have to become entrepreneurs. They have to be competitive because we are on a crisis and we have to compete to have success. And we have to follow this perspective as fast as we are able to. This is the classical rationality. This is the classical conception of the whole thing. In my country, a lot of counselors are there. And they are the counselors themselves that are quite lost there, because this doesn't go anywhere, as you can suspect. The second rationality is this emerging, maybe it's not emerging, it's quite old, But unfortunately, in some secondary schools and in some training schools, it's emerging because it's not well established. And in this emerging conception, we try to work with groups, with communities. The maximum strength you can obtain it by working with a group, with a community. When we are together, when we work together, when we cooperate, when we share information, when we develop collaborative competencies, we have more chances to overcome, to succeed. Of course, there are a lot of barriers. Of course, we are facing a lot of barriers, and these barriers affect us. But the only way that we can fight these barriers is through collaboration. So in my opinion, guidance means collaboration and community. Maybe you are not familiar with human towers. This is a typical expression of the culture of Catalonia. In this culture, there are these groups that are able to build 9-floor towers. You can see the picture. And to do that, and there are contests on that and some meetings in which they do that, you need the collaboration not only from your group wearing the same shirt as you, for example, here in green. You need the collaboration of the whole community. And for me, that's a very nice metaphor, which is also a metaphor brought from this African culture. And of course, saying African culture is like saying European culture. It means almost nothing. But this idea comes from South Africa, from the Xhosa community, in which they have using this concept, Ubuntu. Ubuntu, in that culture, means I am like I am because you are like you are. Or I am the way I am because you are, or you behave, the way you behave. And that means that you can never consider a single person in an isolated way, but belonging to a community. Everybody is like he or she is because he or she belongs to a community. And if you analyze the way the community behaves, you will have clues on understanding how each of the individuals will behave. And this is Ubuntu. We have lost a lot of this conception in these Western countries or Western cultures because we belong to this solipsism or isolated or individualistic cultures in which I am what I am because I want to be what I want to be. Full stop. And nobody cares. For me, it is interesting to recover this idea, this notion of community and of collaboration. Guidance or counseling has its maximum strength when it works from and for the community. And that metaphor explains how this little girl is able to do that 9-floor hike. This little girl climbs through this human tower and is able to do that, and we call it to charge the tower, and that's the climax of the event, to charge the tower. But to do that, and that's the metaphor, this girl is a metaphor of any of the adults or of the young people which you work with, to enable that, we need all that. And it's not only the work of this previous girl who is called a cuchador, who is positioning like this, and then this girl climbs on the top and does that. But you need all the floors. But there's not only the floors, but as I said, all the community. You need all the community to do that. And for me, that's a nice metaphor for guidance and counseling. You cannot pretend helping this person only with this or with this. You need the whole structure, but also the whole community. Of course, if we consider communities, we have to consider diversity because our communities are more and more diverse every day. And there's a couple of examples that shows how diverse can a community be? And I would like to share them with you. One is local and the other one is global. The first one happened in a city close to Barcelona, a 200,000 inhabitant city called Terrassa, in which there was a problem with second generation of migrants. It's quite tricky or quite weird to call them second generation of migrants, because that means that they were born there. You see? But they are still considered second generation of migrants as a label. Right. This second generation of migrants, which were Catalan people born in Catalonia and trained in Catalonia, aged between 16 and 20, spent a lot of time in a square in that village, talking, shouting, having fun, and that generated what we call, or what newspaper called, social alarm. And through that social alarm, the public bodies considered the opportunity of doing something for them. And they realized that they were youngsters, that was smart, youngsters in a process of growing and defining their own identity. So they decided to build a multidisciplinary commission, working group, who had the duty to prepare some kind of toolkit for their families. Because they've realized that their families were lost too, and they didn't know how to work, how to deal with them at that time. Of course, these young people didn't felt very Catalan, because we, the Catalan, somehow rejected them, because they were not like us. They didn't speak Catalan, maybe. They were dressing differently, they looked different. But at the same time, they didn't felt from their fathers or mothers' home countries. They didn't felt Moroccan or whatever. So they were lost somehow. And this commission considered that it was interesting or important to build a toolkit helping their parents to work and to deal with them. And the first concept they tried to integrate in that toolkit was the concept of self-esteem. Are you familiar with that concept? I think so. Self-esteem, because they consider that a youngster normally has problems of self-esteem. They do not recognize very well themselves as being or Catalan, nor Moroccan, nor whatever. They were not very happy about their academic path. Mainly they were dropping out of the educational system. So they considered that maybe starting from that point would be interesting. So let's work with the families to enable them to grow their children, well, not children, their young self-esteem. Do you know what happened? In that multidisciplinary group, there were translators, social educators, counselors, anthropologists. They were trying to find the equivalent to self-esteem in these originary cultures, in these, let's say, African cultures. And do you know which was the word, the closest word they found? Selfish. So, in that culture, which has a group basis, a clan basis, a community basis, there was no concept such as self-esteem. It didn't make sense. Because self-esteem refers to a Western cultural concept based on a single individual. If you are in the middle of the pole and you are alone, you will die. Full stop. If you are in the middle of the jungle and you are alone, you will die. Full stop. So from this anthropological point of view, in that culture, they have developed a sense of being part of a group. And being part of a group is everything there. But that concept, which could be explained from that simple, easy point of view, could be translated into our society. If you are alone in a neoliberal society, you will die. No matter if you are in the middle of Copenhagen, or in the middle of Barcelona, or in the middle of wherever, you will die. First example. So sometimes you pretend to provide the best for the others. But if you don't pay attention on the other's values, on this diversity of values and of conceptions, you will go wrong. And in that case, they have to redesign the initial idea into another way, because self-esteem was not a good starting point. I would like to share with you this other example about this text. I don't know if you know this text, Learning the Treasure Within. That was a text from the UNESCO, and it was written by a commission chaired by Jacques Delors, the president of the European Commission, French president of the European Commission. By the end of the 20th century, UNESCO asked Jacques Delors to make a report, a world report, something as easy as making a world report about the future of education in the world. Something easy. He built a commission, a team, formed only by two Western people, himself and Roberto Carneiro, who was a former education minister in Portugal, and all the rest belonged to other world cultures. And they said, and this was at the end of the 20th century, more or less, by the end. And Roberto Carneiro came to my university to explain that, and this was about to fail. This text was about to be not born because of the following. Once they started, Jacques Delors and Roberto Carneiro said, okay, which could be the starting point to talk about education for the 21st century in a world perspective? And they suggested, why not starting from the Human Rights Declaration? And all the rest of the members of the commission said, okay, if the starting point is the World Declaration of Human Rights, we will leave the commission. It doesn't interest us at all. Why? Because this Universal Human Rights Declaration was written and approved mainly by Western people, in which, again, human rights are based on an individual perspective. They don't consider community rights. They don't consider tribe rights. They don't consider the earth rights and other issues which are crucial for other cultures. So if we talk about communities, we have a challenge, which is paying attention to their values. If we talk about communities, we have to talk about collaborative networking. And networks are these type of structures. It's difficult to represent them in a slide, but you have to imagine a tridimensional net in which there's no hierarchy, in which everybody connects with others through these links. And the important thing is establishing links between people and between communities. So when you are a counselor, you have to work with your participants, which could be one or some of them, but you also have to work with educators, with teachers, with other stakeholders and agents working in a territory. And this perspective is fractal, like the broccoli. Do you know what a fractal is? It's the only physics concept I know. But it helps me to say that in such a forum. A fractal is a structure that repeats itself no matter the portion of the structure you consider. So if you take a whole broccoli, you can see that the structure is made by branches, right? But if you take a piece of the whole structure, again, you have branches. And if you take that piece, you will see also branches. So this structure repeats itself no matter the portion you take. Our networks should be considered in the same way. So this is a huge network here. You are more than 280 people, I was told, more or less. You belong to different organizations. Some of you belong to the Youth Education Counselors Organization, some don't. So that shows that you can network here pretty well, within the organization or in between people not belonging to it. And that's really important because through this networking, you build safety networks. And I like this metaphor with this Tokyo public transport map. I've been in Tokyo once, and I've realized how well connected were all the systems in the public transport. And this is, again, an analogy for what we should do, in my opinion. So when you are here and you want to go there, you can go this way, then switch in this station and take this other way, switch here, and then you are there. But maybe when you are here, you change your mind. Or something happened in your itinerary. If this happens here, you have chances. You have opportunities. You can go this way or either this way, or maybe you can switch here and go through the blue one. So in a community, in a neighborhood, in a municipality, it's important to build these networks and to connect secondary education schools with adult education schools, with second chance opportunity programs, with counseling services, or whatever, and with other associations or whatever. Only if we build this type of networks, we will be able to provide true opportunities for people. I've been once working with a municipality in which they have what they call these second chance opportunity programs, in which they work with dropouts, people failing from secondary school, trying to re-motivate them to re-engage in a certain type of education itinerary. They were quite successful. They convinced a lot of people, and they worked with a lot of people, and these people redefined their itineraries. They reinterpret their failures, and they were able to continue. But they couldn't, because there was no connections between what they were doing, let's say here, with the rest of available itineraries. That's a true pity. So when you work with a person aged, let's say, 17, who doesn't want at all to return to school, you have to make sure that there will be a certain type of alternative to school for him or her after you work with him or her. And that's a network. And that's crucial to work with. And this is linked with that idea of collaboration and of the human towers and of community working and so on. So, no linear itineraries. You can have failures. That's normal. It's normal that a person redefines his or her itinerary during his or her life. And you are not alone. It's not true that you have to be that competitive. It's not true that you have to fight alone for your welfare. In the last research we've done, we have identified something which was really evident, but we have proofs through the research. We have identified 7 barriers for employment and for development, which are very simple, but very strong. The first one, of course, is the economic model. This neoliberal capitalist model is the first problem we have to face. In this model, competitiveness is the way you have to interact with your peers, competing. In this model, it's normal that from time to time, there's an economic crisis. That's normal. It happens, like a earthquake or like a storm, whatever. It's normal that in this economic model, we have crisis. To face that crisis, it's normal as well to use these policies, especially in southern countries, ruled by right-wing parties. It's normal to rule policies of budget cuts. So the paradox is you have an enormous crisis, economical crisis, with a lot of unemployment, and the government simply decides to cut budgets on social welfare programs, on counseling programs, on guidance programs, etc. And that's normal. Of course, that's a huge barrier. That model generates socio-economical inequalities. which are not fair at all, because it's a lottery. If you are born and raised in a powerful family, it's a lottery. If you are born and raised in a poor family, it's a lottery again, so it's unfair. But the model doesn't provide true chances for those vulnerable to overcome and to have better chances. The fourth barrier are stereotypes, discrimination on the base of whatever, age, gender, ethnicity, origin, sexual orientation, training credentials. We have interviewed more than 800 responsible of human resources of any kind of enterprises in Catalonia. And a worrying percentage of them accepted that there were different chances depending on your ethnicity, your origin, your sexual orientation, your trading credentials, your age, or your gender. It's well known that, at least in Spain, a woman earns 30% less than a man for doing the same job in certain private companies. Not in public companies, of course, but in private, yes. So now there was a new in a newspaper saying that from this week on, most of the women working in private companies were working for free until the end of the year in Spain. Of course, the educational system under permanent legal changes is something that doesn't help at all. So every time we change the sign of the government, we have a legal change. The Educational Act changes completely. The priorities changes. Based on what? Based on nothing. There's no surveys, there's no evaluations, there's nothing. It's simply that they want to do things in a different way than their predecessors. Maybe that's familiar for you, I've heard. And finally, this guidance system, this guidance provision, or this counseling provision as well, with shortcomings. Considering guidance or counseling as a service, considering counseling as interviewing each person once, at the end of the compulsory education system, or, for example, organizing a set of two or three speaks to tell them opportunities in the labor market. Let's bring a doctor, a nurse, a fireman, a policeman, a lawyer, and a teacher, for example, and let's talk about occupational opportunities, for example. Or let's visit a set of three or four enterprises to see how they work. These are barriers that we have to face daily. Of course, if you have resources, if you belong to an empowered family, if you are a second generation of a person with a university degree, that's like an initiation ritual. But if you belong to the working class, or if you belong to a vulnerable family, or to an unstructured or destructured family, or whatever, these are true barriers. Huge barriers that you have to face every day, no matter if you have credentials. You will not have chances. Fortunately, there are ways of facing that barriers, because it's not your fault that those barriers exist, at least partially. And we have identified 20 skills to fight those barriers. And I want to refer only to some of them. What time is it? It's 4 o'clock, so it's almost 1 hour speaking. Okay, so some of them are classical skills that anyone would say are helpful to work. For example, speaking in public. I have students ending their career, their university studies, not able to have to give a speech in a public space, not feeling comfortable having to speak to an audience, for example. What happens if we consider a person who is quitting secondary school or vet education? What happens to them? Because if you are able to speak in public, you can express ideas, thoughts, whatever. Of course, there are others that are quite classical. Self-discipline. This is very well evaluated by employers. Or initiative, some kind of initiative. But I would like to underline some of them. For example, these ones. Critical analysis. Being able to analyze which type of messages are you receiving daily, through TV, through the news. Which type of messages are hidden in what people say to you daily. That's a key issue to fight the other's barriers. Dialoguing and active listening. Dialogue is another key skill, because sometimes we are trained on accepting that power positions have more rights or are more true than those not occupying that positions. So dialoguing implies dialogos, an exchange between rationalities that accept they are at the same level, that recognize mutually as being valid interlocutors. Dialoguing means that I have a reasonable opportunity of changing the other's mind, and the other has reasonable opportunities of changing the way that I think. That's dialogue. It's not persuasion. It's not discussion. It's an interaction, an exchange in which you can modify the other's point of view. For example, like when that commission changed the point of view of the lawyers, and they accepted not to start with the Human Rights Declaration. And they've built another way of considering what education should be in the 21st century, for example. But I like very much this one. Using resources to protect rights. What does that mean? In my country, I would say that when you see, when you are an eyewitness of harassment, of bullying, most of the people simply don't know what to do. Apart from intervening directly. But that's not a very skilled actuation. So in my country, most of the times you are an eyewitness of an inequality situation or a non-socially fair situation, you simply don't know what to do. You are not trained for that. We are not trained to use resources to protect rights. We don't know where to go. We don't know what to say. We don't know how to get together to protect ourselves or to protect others. In terms of labor, in terms of whatever, in terms of welfare. We simply don't know what to do. That's a crucial skill nowadays, in my opinion. If you want to help people to overcome their situation, to work together, and to have reasonable opportunities of success, we have to consider that skill. There's others. For example, social self-management, or, for example, empathy and taking care of others, which could be connected with this social entrepreneurship. Because I criticized the entrepreneurship concept, but I think entrepreneurship is a nice concept if we link it with the word social. So let's entrepreneur together. Let's work together to build something interesting for us. Okay, there's some more, but we do not have time for them. But I think it's interesting to consider if we, through our work, are promoting these skills or not. In my opinion, if we promote these skills, we are trying to solve the problem. If we do not promote these skills, we are part of the problem. Sometimes we forget also that when we are in a training itinerary, we face transitions without considering two prior goals that must be guaranteed, which are a quality basic training and a professional qualification. In my country, a lot of counselors work with unemployed, working directly with this concept of transition. Okay, you are unemployed, you want to get into the labor market, okay, let's prepare the CV. Let's prepare how to do a nice job interview. Let's prepare how to write a presentation letter. To do what? To go where? If you don't have a quality basic training, and we define quality basic training not only having compulsory education accredited, but also having developed some of those competences I was mentioning before. That's a quality-based training. And a quality base, as the word says itself, it's simply the base from which you can build something on top. So you need this quality basic training before, and then you need some type of professional qualification through vet education or through occupational training or whatever. And after that, you can face transition to the labor market. If not, most of these people are not going to have success. So guidance in this context is, it's a continued process, not only punctual. It's for everybody, for all. It's participative. You cannot build anything without the participation of the people you are working with. That's why I call them participants, not clients. It should be territorially based and collaborative, and it should generate personal and community projects. Not only personal, but also community projects. And it has to consider these continuities we were mentioning. Of course, there are people that are having success all over their path, but there's a lot of people with these successful discontinuities. So this model is based on networking, as I said, in considering the diversity of roles and functions, because if we consider a network, then we have to consider the role of... This is running. Come on. The machine is giving me a message. I have to finish soon. Okay, I will finish if I'm in 5 minutes, and then it will be your turn. I was saying, this networking way of considering guidance and counseling should consider different roles. So, for example, the role, of course, of the counselor, the role of teachers, the roles of social educators, of social workers, and so on. Because as in the health model, not everybody does the same. And in some contexts, in my experience, I have seen that different roles are doing the same. So teachers are expected to counsel their students. Counselors are expected to counsel participants or young people or whatever. Social workers are expected to counsel. So if everybody with different roles, with different training backgrounds are doing the same, what the hell we are doing? I think that in a network, you have to clarify, like in the health system, that a person dedicated to nursing services or taking care from the nursing point of view does not the same things that a surgeon does. And a family doctor does not the same things as the person who sells you herbs to make an infusion for your stomachache, for example. And all of them belong to this health care system. And of course, in this health care system, you need also health education at schools. But you do not have surgery at schools. Why then, when you consider guidance and counseling, you are doing the same everywhere sometimes? For me, if we call about networks, we have to clearly define which are the roles based on standards of quality standards. And this model, of course, must be non-prescriptive but inspirational. So it's quite nice to have a different way of counseling if you are in a territory or if you are in another territory, because each territory has its own particularities. And you have to start from that particularities. And teams here are different from teams 100 kilometers from here. And based on a general model, every team must work and get inspired by the others, but not copy or do exactly the same. In the educational system, we could say, okay, oops, it is working. Yes, again. We can consider some different stages. For example, it's important to do things to facilitate the access to the system? How do we welcome people to schools? How do we help people to get familiar about the way we work in that school or in that educational center or in that training center? How do we work to develop personal, academic, and vocational skills during the path? How we try to help people to build ongoing and future projects, training projects, vocational projects, professional or labor projects, or life projects? How we help them to accreditate, because accreditation is not the only important thing, but it is important. And finally, how can we help them to transfer to the post-compulsory stage? So, the first is the access, then academic guidance and vocational guidance. You can say counseling here. For me, there's no differences in this forum. And I believe that this must be infused, and that's a very interesting concept, in my opinion. So when we work in educational settings, in training settings, I think the most important thing we have to work with and to do with is during the training, and not apart from the training. So when you devote 6 hours a day being trained in a class, that's the main opportunity you have to grow things. And infusion refers to that. The curriculum is the hot water. And these counseling activities or guidance activities should be infused there, meaning that the most important thing is to do the training in a different way we normally do. Because if we face, for example, people who are not motivated, it would be very hard to motivate them outside the classroom if what demotivates them happens inside the classroom. So what are we doing in a counseling interview trying to motivate a young student if this demotivation has grown during the maths or the English or the language or the social sciences classes? It is there where we have to act, in my opinion. And that's curricular infusion. So of course it's nice to do extra activities, added activities concerning counseling, but we have to consider what is happening inside the classrooms. Because inside the classrooms, we can find the engine promoting and building empowerment, social cohesion, or the contrary, demotivation, low self-esteem, and whatever. So social justice, to sum up, it's a network challenge. It's not an individual or a professional challenge, and I would give you 10 final ideas. First, of course, we have to identify needs, but also opportunities and goals, and we have to be very clear for that. Second, we have to identify actors, different actors. A counselor is not an isolated professional. He or she must work, we must work with other actors, with teachers, with social educators, with other actors in the territory, with families as well. And of course, we have to train them, to monitor them, and to supervise them if we are dealing with counseling. Because the professionals of counseling are counselors, not teachers, not social educators, or whatever. Third, we have to promote mutual knowledge. In my country, at least, there's a huge lack of understanding of what the other professionals are really doing. Sometimes when you get closer, you realize that you are doing almost the same. Almost the same. So you can sometimes identify a huge network of professionals not being very well coordinated and not changing really the situation of the people to whom they work for. So this mutual knowledge must clarify functions, attribution, actions, roles, standards, etc. Of course, we need a guidance model, an inspirating guidance model, in which we make clear that we have to promote these basic skills first, this vocational training then, and afterwards, this transition process. Of course, we need a system of management and of communication. Management means making the little and the smaller meetings as possible, because we devote a lot of time meeting with others, and that is a waste, a terrible waste of time. So managing means the minimum coordination for the maximum improvement. So having simple but effective structures, not always meeting face-to-face, here we can use ICTs or whatever, documenting and sharing, that's a pending issue in my country. We work hard, but we don't write. We are in an oral tradition. So what's going on with that person? Okay, I will tell you. No, you don't have to tell me. Isn't there any kind of record? Any kind of written information? The way you are working, don't you have it written and digitally available? That's crucial nowadays, to share information, to share knowledge. Of course, following up and supervising procedures through quality standards. And finally, from an ethics commitment with the community. In some of my secondary schools, they counsel students to enter to what they offer in the same school after compulsory education. So what you should do after completing secondary education? A BET course that, by the way, I am organizing. That's not fair. That's against ethics, because that's against their own interest. Of course, they need to have the groups full of people, because otherwise they will have budget cuts. But the way avoiding these budget cuts is not convincing people to go to your own offer. Social justice, to sum up, of course, must be in our discourse, in our plans, but it must be really clear in our goals, in our mottos, because our goals must not refer to what we have done, like it is happening in my country sometimes. You can see a report saying what you have done, not what you wanted to do. And this is like an iceberg. This is the visible part of a huge part which is not frequently seen, which is how are we trained, which are the quality standards are we following, and which is the ethics of our profession. I've brought to you three references. One is in Spanish, I'm sorry, but the other two are in English. And all refer to these social justice issues in education in my country. And the last one will be soon available. It's about to be on the libraries next month. So it's brand new. And the other ones are already available. So, thank you very much. Mangetak.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, okay. Perfectly.
You mentioned the curricular infusion. I understood it on a theoretical level, but what did you mean, practically speaking? Like, how would that go on?
Okay, for example, in my country, in my university, we have developed some guidance programs to be infused in the curriculum. For example, self-esteem and motivation. In our context, we believe that these are two crucial issues for young people. So if we try to provide opportunities for people, we have to make clear that their motivation is high and their self-esteem is positive and realistic, right? We can do it both in two different ways. First way, in a traditional way. Okay, we find a demotivated person or a person with low self-esteem. Okay, we call him or her to our office and we make a set of activities, whatever. An interview, we give that person a questionnaire first, and then we, through interviews, we try to change the situation. For me, that's the classical way, and it doesn't pay attention to what has caused this situation. And in my opinion, and it's an hypothesis, that situation was caused by what has happened inside the class. So we developed a program in which we help, we train teachers to work with motivation and self-esteem through their lessons. How? What motivates a person? For example, the theory says that when you have an internal locus of control, for example, that's a classical theory. If you control what happens to you, your motivation increases. If you devote 2 hours to study an exam and you pass the exam with a good mark, motivation increases. And that gives you a sense of control. And on the opposite, if you dedicate 2 hours studying for an exam and you fail, and you dedicate 6 hours to prepare the same exam and you keep failing, your motivation decreases, right? So experience tells us that if you want to increase motivation, you have to provide true opportunities of success to your pupils, to your students. Say it in another way. If you only provide failure experiences, you will easily have a demotivated class. Some professors, some teachers argued, okay, so you are suggesting to make things easy and to decrease the level of the group. And that's not the thing. So when a student asks you a question, maybe it's not an accurate question, but if you face it, taking into account that depending on your answer, these students will be able to formulate new questions and new opportunities for learning, or he or she will decide not to ask again, you are growing or decreasing motivation. And through all these activities, you are teaching maths or whatever, and at the same time, you are preventing to damage motivation on your students. That's the way. And that's an infusion, because that means that the professor doesn't have to do extra work. His or her classes are exactly the same hours, week hours. But he or she transforms the quality of what he or she is doing. And some teachers are not skilled on that, and they simply don't pay attention to that. So when a teacher said, do you know what she has asked to a group, by this behavior is damaging that person's motivation, for example, or self-esteem. When you say, for example, you, come on, that person has a name. That deals with self-esteem. If you refer to your pupils, that's basic principles. But sometimes you simply don't pay attention to that. That's infusion. And there's a program prepared to train professors or teachers to work with that, to deal with that, to understand that psychopedagogical processes that are running during classes. That was it.
Yes, yeah. That's better. It was very interesting what you said about this. You called it an African view of what a human being is, this more collective idea. Do you have some ideas for sort of first steps, a way that we could begin to think like that? I mean, in our culture, we're infused by the other idea that we're all individuals, and it's very difficult to turn that ship around. What should we do first? I mean, does it start by sort of looking into ourselves and beginning to think of ourselves as parts of groups and not individuals, and then relating to our students in the same way?
I would say so. So you belong to an institution in which you work with others, and there's ways of discussing what do you want for that institution, for example. You work with other people, you are in charge of them somehow, and you can change your mind on the way you are working with them. You can introduce communicative skills on that, and also this collaborative perspective on the way you work. So when you do a meeting, you can consider the meeting in a very traditional way. For example, when you do a meeting, there's something, somebody who is organizing that meeting from a professional point of view, right? Sometimes in that meetings, I don't know if that will be familiar for you. Listen, imagine that situation, okay? There's a person convoking the others to a meeting, okay? Calling for a meeting. And then the meeting takes place. And there's one person who is the formal leader of the meeting. What are the rest doing? Some of them could be listening and actively participating in the meeting, right? Sometimes there's some people correcting exams at the same time in that meeting. Some others are checking the email in that meeting, or some others are checking Facebook. Not in Denmark, of course. Of course, I am talking about Spain. Of course, not in Denmark. And at the end of the meeting, somebody says, okay, which were the agreements? That shows that individualistic way of behaving. So in very simple activities, daily activities, you can introduce this perspective of, in a meeting, it's like being in a boat and everybody must, how do you say, rowing? Everybody must do that, because otherwise this is not going to work. So I think being aware of that, of belonging to a community, is something that you can do from very simple activities. For example, in my country, it's very common to say hello to the others using almost a sound. Hey! And the others say, hey! And that's all. And we have a mother of one of the children of a school suggesting to recover these courtesy ways of communicating, saying, good morning, how are you? But willing or pretending the other to tell you how he or she is. Because sometimes we say, hey, how are you? And the other says, how are you? And then you go. So it's not properly a question. It's a way of saying hello. And in my department, there's a colleague who says, ch-. And then I said, ch-. Things like that. That's the beginning. Of course, if you have diversity in your institution, that's easier. Because when you have diversity, through dialogue, which is that crucial concept I was mentioning before too, dialogue means considering the other as a valid person to talk with. If you have diversity and you dialogue, so that means exposing your ideas and having the reasonable chance to modify each other's ideas, that helps as well. So at the beginning, I would say it must be transformed into an attitude and some very little and very simple translations into practice of this attitude, I would say. Come on, react.
What about the examinations?
What do you mean, the examinations?
They're individual. Most of them are.
Ah, that's true. That's a nice point of view. Yes, why do we have to do everything through an individual examination? Of course, we have evidences of other types of practices nowadays, which have quite a long path. For example, peer evaluation. For example, group evaluation. Of course, we can argue that at some extent, we need an individual record of performance. Of course, to some extent, we need an individual record. But not everything. Not everything. Now we are developing in my department the methodology through which peers will evaluate individually the others in a group work. That's a step. But there's also that thing about considering the evaluation between them through rubrics or other methodologies which already exists. Of course, the way you evaluate tells you the way you teach. So if you transform evaluation, you have the chance to transform teaching. And if you transform teaching, you have to transform evaluation. For sure.
Do you know? Sorry.
Last reaction.
In Africa, what about hierarchies? Do they? I don't know how much you know about Africa. But that was just your example, but hierarchy is very important in our society.
Hierarchy?
Hierarchy, yes. Yeah. There are differences between people, and some people talk down to others, and others talk up to the first ones. Is that a problem? Of course it's a problem, but if it's a sort of suppressive. But it's just such an important thing in our Western culture. It's difficult to imagine that it could be just made away with.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's possible?
I think we can at least combine both. I mean, if we consider complex organizations, such as school or a municipality or a community, which is a complex organization, maybe we do need some form of hierarchy, of structure. Maybe we need that. Okay, we do have that. But at the same time, we can also combine that with participatory initiatives. For example, in municipalities all over the world, it's maybe 2 decades that in some cities, some of them quite big, they are doing what they call participatory budgets, in which, for example, a town hall, a mayor decides to give the population the opportunity of deciding where to invest, for example, 2 million euros of the municipal budget. And then there's a call through which individuals, groups, associations can suggest ways, places, programs, or activities in which to invest part of the municipal budget. That's a different way of considering how to decide where to invest public money. Because it's ours. This money is ours. That's a way, for example. In the perspective of critic pedagogy, from which I feel very comfortable, they say that when you are talking with another person who is maybe in a higher hierarchy of power, no matter who is saying what, the important thing is what is he or she saying. And that is linked with the idea of validity of arguments. The validity of arguments. Meaning that when something is interesting, no matter who has said that. And when a person is in the power, if what he or she says is not interesting, it has no value. And this is the validity of argument. And who gives validity to the arguments, to the statements, people, common sense. So, for example, when in a school in my country, someone said, okay, why don't we open school from 5 afternoon until 9? In my country, schools end at 5 p.m. Okay? So until 5, they are at school. And someone suggested, why don't we open schools from 5 to 9 for those that don't have resources at home to do homework, to study, to do whatever, and they will do it at the school with a nice place, heated, with nice lighting, or whatever. This was said by a mother. No power at all. But the argument was valid. So they look for the way of opening the school that period. So when you face these hierarchies, I think the important issue is to consider validity of arguments and to combine structures, which are needed in complex organizations, to share, to distribute roles, duties, and whatever, to combine that with this dialogical perspective in which no matter who says what, the important thing is what everyone says.
And that's the last word.
Oh. Thank you. I would have been hours talking with you, but that will be next time.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.